when I was in my office right before I came to class, I noticed that I had the wrong schedule of lectures posted. Where is the schedule of lectures, by the way? On what? But I mean specifically where? Yes, on the syllabus. Don't forget that. It's the only place that the lecture schedule is posted. Well, it was wrong, which means that exam one is not this week. It's on Tuesday. So that has already been changed. I just haven't had time yet to change the due date for the exam itself on Canvas, but I will today, after we're done here today. So I have two more lectures to finish up the unit, today and Thursday, and then exam one will be Tuesday. We didn't get very deeply into this water and the fitness of the environment chapter, just one slide away. Starting with slide two, we're looking at specific reasons why water is such a special substance and why that specialness is important to biology. The reasons are different. There's several different properties that are special, but those properties all spring from the fact that water is a polar molecule, which is what we covered last time. This first example in slide two has to do with movement of water through plants. The movement of water through a plant is called transpiration. Transpiration is one-way movement of water because water enters a plant like this tree at the roots from the soil. That's where it gets into the plant. Then it travels upward through the body of the plant, however big it is, and then eventually exits or leaves through the leaves. That's transpiration. And that's necessary to keep the plant alive. But notice that is an uphill movement of water, which is against gravity. And that takes some energy. It takes force to do that. If you consider a faucet in your house, for instance, you're used to being able to turn the handle and the water comes out, right? It comes out because it's pressurized. But why is it pressurized? Why is the pressure higher in the pipe than it is outside? What causes the pressure? Gravity causes that pressure. Most people don't think about it. But the reason that your water is pressurized is because there's a lot of water higher than your house contained somewhere in the city. In the plain states where there are no hills, you see water towers that are taller than houses. Big tanks of water. So water is really falling downhill to come into your house. Here, we put water tanks on mesas around town. You can see them if you pay attention. But anyway, if you build a building that's taller than the tanks, water is not going to get to the top of that building. Doesn't go uphill for free, right? So like build a skyscraper, for instance, you have to have a dedicated pump in that building using electrical energy to pump it uphill so that you can have faucets that work at the top floor. Well, there's no electrical pump in a tree, for instance, or any other plant. Still, though, water has to go against gravity just like it has to in a building. And if you consider sequoia trees, which are the largest organisms that have ever existed, far bigger than dinosaurs, but vertically arranged, right? They are tall. They're as tall as tall buildings. They get their water to the top, otherwise they wouldn't be able to live, not from an electrical pump, but because of hydrogen bonding in water molecules. Specifically through a mechanism called capillary attraction. You know, if you lance your finger to make a little droplet of blood and then put a glass capillary tube on it, the blood will seem like it's being sucked up the tube, right? It goes against gravity. Similarly, water moves uphill in the tiny vessels that make up a tree. Water-conducting vessels, called xylem, are what we're looking at in close-up in cartoon form here on the right. And there are two different attractive forces labeled here. They're really caused by the same thing. It's because of hydrogen bonding. But we distinguish adhesion from cohesion for a simple reason. Co means share, just like in covalent. Cohesion is the force of attraction between particles of the same type. So when you have a population of water molecules that are all the same type of molecules, they cohere, or they have cohesive force because they're polar, and therefore there are hydrogen bonds that form between them, like we've already discussed. Adhesion is the same thing. It's hydrogen bonds forming, but we call it adhesion when it's attraction between particles of different types. And they're both at play here in getting water to the top of the tree. This is the inside of a tiny diameter xylem vessel in the tree. These are individual water molecules. So we're really close up here. But anyway, the water molecules that which are polar molecules are actually attracted to the molecules that make up the walls of the vessels. And so since they're not the same kind of molecules, that's adhesion. But water molecules are also attracted to each other in this column of water. They're the same type, so that's cohesion. The water that's transpiring up a plant is really like a long train of molecules. Just like a freight train. Right? A train is made up of many cars, each of which is linked to each other. Pulled from the front by an engine, but then all the cars are linked behind it. Well, the links in that analogy are the hydrogen bonds between water molecules, except it's moving vertically instead of horizontally like a normal train. What causes the engine, which is the first water molecule at the top, to go even higher is adhesion, because it's attracted to the walls by hydrogen bonding. And remember I said that water is continuously leaving at the leaves. It's evaporating. That's leaving space at the top of the tube. And then the now leading water molecule that's still left behind in liquid form is going to be pulled upward to fill that space. And it's going to pull on all the ones behind it one by one in a continuous train-like linkage based on hydrogen bonding. And so each individual hydrogen bond is very weak. A hydrogen bond is not a chemical bond, remember. It's way weaker than even the weakest chemical bond, which is ionic bonds. It doesn't make new stuff, but it is attractive. It's more than nothing. It's more than zero attraction. And there's a lot of them, so they add up. Well, it's probable that sequoias have evolved to be just about as high as any plant can be, because the higher you make it, the longer the train is, the heavier it gets, the more gravity's pulling on it. And therefore, if you get it any higher, gravity wins out and breaks some links. If you break a link between any of the cars behind the engine of the train, the engine will keep going, but everything else will be left behind. It'll cavitate, in other words. Let's go to slide 3. Look at another example. This one involves an animal walking on water. And not all animals can do this. If we try to walk on water, we're going to sink. This one doesn't. Notice at the footprints, where it's actually contacting the water, you can see that the surface of the water is being deformed by each leg. It's not piercing, though, because that deformation looks almost like it's a somewhat thicker skin right at the surface of water. Well, it doesn't just seem like that. It's actually true. Let me draw a beaker of water to try to explain this. you have a water, however deep it is, made up of trillions and trillions of water molecules. They're all attracted to each other, right? Because they're all polar molecules. So there are hydrogen bonds forming. But at depth, meaning any water molecule other than at the surface, that every one of those water molecules is more or less being equally attracted to other water molecules in all directions. It's being pulled in all directions, in other words. So they're, on average, pretty evenly spaced out. That's not true at the surface, though. For the water molecules that are at the surface, they are being pulled downward because there are water molecules below them. But they're not also being pulled upward since there aren't water molecules above them. And therefore, compared to the water molecules at depth, the ones at the surface are being compressed together a little bit more. So it really is a thicker skin of water that's denser than the regular liquid water below. And then that's just enough of a difference for this animal to walk on the water. Now to a map in slide 4, which I'll use to explain two different properties of water that are important to biology. It doesn't matter where we are. This is a specific example, obviously, LA. But that's not what's important. What's important is that we have a large body of water next to a large land mass. And that occurs a lot of places in the world. There is a one property of water that is important here that's called the specific heat capacity. Now, I said property of water. Actually, any substance has a specific heat capacity. What's just different about different substances is the value of that. But any given substance, you can measure a specific heat capacity. So I need to define what that is. The specific heat capacity of whatever substance you're talking about is the amount of energy required to raise the temperature of 1 gram of that stuff, whatever it is, by 1 Kelvin, or 1 degree Celsius. Since Kelvins and degrees Celsius are the same size, it doesn't matter which way when you use. Okay? Now that's per gram, so it doesn't matter how much you have. It's going to be the same volume. I mean, the same value. Any given substance, though, has a specific value for the specific heat capacity. And that definition should tell you that it really is a measure of how easy or difficult it is to heat that stuff up. The higher the value of specific heat capacity, the more energy required to raise it 1 degree. And so, for instance, in cooking, it is a lot harder to heat up water than it is to, with the same amount of energy, than it is to heat up the same volume of oil. You put oil in a pan, it gets hot quickly. You put water in a pan, you're going to have to wait a little bit because it has a much higher specific heat capacity. The reason this is so important to biology, using this map, is that because water is comparatively hard to heat up, and, by the way, also hard to cool down for the same reason. Specific heat capacity is at play there, too. Because of that, the temperature of large bodies of water, which goes up and down just like land does, you know, it gets warmer during the day and cooler at night. So it's from day to day there is an oscillation of the temperature. But for large bodies of water, the amplitude, which is the difference between the high point and the low point, is smaller because of that high specific heat capacity. In other words, large bodies of water are thermally more consistent. They don't undergo such extremes. The land mass, on the other hand, is going to get hotter during the day and colder at night than water does. More inconsistent. And this is just one of multiple reasons why life started out the first successful cells that are the ancestors to all of us, they started out in the ocean. Life started in the ocean, and for a long time, that's the only place there was life. We are terrestrial organisms, so we naturally think about life on land. But that's a comparatively new thing. For billions of years, there were only life in the oceans. But it makes sense, considering that it's a much more stable environment than land is. So that's one property, specific heat capacity. There's another property of water, or of substances in general, called latent heat of vaporization. And vaporization really is just another word for evaporation. So you can measure this just like specific heat capacity. You can measure this for whatever kind of substance. But just like water compared to most substances has a high specific heat capacity, also water compared to most substances has a high latent heat of vaporization, which I still haven't defined. The latent heat of vaporization for any given substance is the amount of energy required to convert 1 gram of that stuff from liquid form to gas form. In other words, the energy required to evaporate 1 gram of that stuff. And like I said, water has a pretty high value. This saves your life, literally saves your life, especially living in Phoenix, all the time. We are mammals. Mammals form sweat. Sweat is mostly water, though. It's a mixture of stuff. There are some salts in it and other things, waste products, but it's mostly water. But we have glands specialized in putting that water onto our skin, which then evaporates, saving our lives. We would overheat and die without this. Even though you don't really feel it happening, usually. For instance, if you go out and ride a bike in July, you feel fine. You know, you ride it a mile or whatever, you're feeling fine. It doesn't feel like you're even sweating. And then you stop at a convenience store or whatever, and all of a sudden it seems like you've just started sweating profusely. You're just soaked. Well, you've been sweating at that rate the whole time you were riding. That's what saved your life. That's why you were able to survive the trip. It's just that it was evaporating quickly because as you ride through the air, more wind basically takes that liquid form and evaporates it quickly. And that takes a lot of heat from your body. That's why if you weren't able to do that, you would collapse. Your body temperature would get lethally high. Let me explain a couple things about evaporation. Evaporation of water cools the liquid from which the evaporation is occurring, and that's what cools your body because the liquid is on your body to begin with. So it cools the liquid that's left behind when you evaporate from that liquid. But it also cools the air into which the evaporation occurs, which might, to some of you, seem counterintuitive. You might think it makes sense for if something's cooling, the other thing would heat up. But actually, they're both cooled. And to explain this, you have to think back to what I told you in lab. Temperature is. What is temperature? Remember, I explained the difference between heat and temperature. Heat is the energy of thermal motion. It's the energy of the motion of the particles. Therefore, the more particles you have, the more stuff you have, the more heat there is. It's an extensive property. Temperature is not. Temperature is proportional to the average speed of the particles. So you, in an average, you divide by however much you have, and therefore, it's an intensive property. Doesn't matter how much you have, the temperature is the average speed of those particles. All right, so think of this beaker again, but now for a different reason. You have trillions of water molecules in here bouncing around. Why are they a liquid, first of all? Why are they not gas? What's the big difference? No. What really distinguishes a liquid from a gas? No, the molecules are identical. And that's why evaporation is not a chemical change. You don't turn it into a different kind of molecule when you evaporate.
The spacing of the molecules?
The spacing of the particles, in this case, molecules. That's right. In a liquid, the particles are much closer together than they are in a gas. It's mostly space between particles in a gas. In a liquid, they're much more tightly spaced. So they're bouncing around in this liquid phase. But if you're going to evaporate that some of that water, that means some of that population, some of those molecules in the liquid population, need to escape the liquid and go off in their own into the air. All right, now, first of all, most of them don't have a chance to do that at this moment because they are at depth, right? They're just going to run into other water molecules around them. They can't escape, really. The only ones that really have a chance to escape are the ones at the surface. And that's always changing because it's moving around. But at any given moment in time, only the ones at the surface have a chance of evaporating. Evaporation occurs from the surface of the liquid, in other words. But that's even not enough because they're all moving in random directions at any given moment. So even if a water molecule is at the surface, if it happens to be moving toward the depth of the water, it's not going to escape either, right? It's going in the opposite direction. But if you're one of those water molecules that's at the surface and just happens to be moving toward the air, you at least have a chance to escape the liquid population or evaporate. Well, what gives you an even better chance? Let's just consider only the water molecules that are at the surface and moving in the right direction toward the air. Which ones of those are going to have the best chance? Think of them as little rockets that need to leave. Right. Which ones are the fastest? Those have the best chance. They're all moving at random directions, but also they all have different speeds. Well, the ones that are moving fastest have the best chance of leaving that population of liquid. Does that make sense? Okay, now what did I say temperature is? Average speed. So if this happens, if the fastest of the water molecules are leaving the liquid population, and you recalculate the new average without those fastest ones, because they're now in the gas phase, what is the new average going to be? Average speed.
Lower,
because you've lost the fastest ones of the class or of the population. And lower average speed is lower temperature, so the water gets cool. You know, if you take a rag and get it soaked with water that's just barely standable to touch, it's so hot. And you spread it out and just flap it in the air 10 times, it not only will be not hot anymore, it'll be actually cold to the touch because evaporation cools the water that's left behind for this reason. And that's why sweating saves your life. Okay, so that's why the cooling of the liquid happens, but it also cools the air. And that's because the air has a population of water molecules in it that are comparatively fast moving. That's why they're in the air, because they've escaped. And when you add new water molecules, some of those will be ones that just barely escaped, just barely were fast enough. So really, when you're adding those water molecules to the air that have escaped, you're adding ones that are actually lower on average speed than the ones that are already in the gas. So once again, the new average is lower. It cools both. This is exactly how an evaporative cooler works if you have one in your house. You pump water onto a mat and blow air through it. That evaporates. That cools the water, but it also cools the air that the water is evaporating into. And that now cool and humid air gets pumped through your house to cool the house. The reason, by the way, that both of these are a consequence of the fact that water is polar is because specific heat capacity is how hard it is to heat up. Well, to remember that heating it up means increasing the speed. If you have a population of nonpolar molecules that are not attracted to each other, more of that energy that you're putting in can be put into just making them faster. But in water, a polar substance, some of that energy is spent just to break those hydrogen bonds before you can then speed them up. So they don't end up getting as fast and therefore don't get as hot. Does that make sense? And similarly for evaporation, if you're intentionally heating water to boil it, some of that energy is going to go into just breaking the hydrogen bonds before they can get fast enough to escape the liquid. Okay, now to five. Here we have a picture of, in the middle, a photograph of an animal below the surface of a frozen body of water. Ice at the surface and liquid below. Well, solid water or ice is unusual. In almost all cases of other substances, a solid version of that stuff is even more dense than the liquid version. We talked about what distinguishes a liquid and a gas. Well, what distinguishes a liquid and a solid is that a solid has even closer spacing usually. Also, the particles are not in a solid are no longer exchanging positions. They're rattling in place, so there's motion, but they're staying with respect to the other particles in place. And therefore, solids have a definite shape. They don't just spill into whatever the shape of the container is, like liquids do. But in both cases, they're much more closely spaced than gas, and in almost all substances, the solid version has even tighter spacing between particles than the liquid does. And density of a substance refers to how much mass there is in a given volume of that stuff. It's mass per volume. Well, the closer they are spaced together, the more mass there is in whatever unit of volume you use. In other words, the density is higher, the higher the spacing, or the tighter the spacing. That's the usual case, but it's not for water. For water, the solid version, which we call ice, is actually less dense than the liquid version. And just like in this photograph, you notice this with a cocktail or whatever you're drinking that has ice in it. Or just, let's not say a cocktail, let's just say ice water so that we're dealing with nothing but water molecules. If you have a glass of ice water, the ice cubes float, right? Well, for almost any other substance in the world, if you put a solid version of that stuff, whatever it is, into a glass of liquid version of that stuff, the solid's going to go to the bottom because it's more dense. Water doesn't. And that's one reason why we're here. We wouldn't exist without this. What I mean here is that if you consider a body of water, which remember is where life got started, it undergoes seasonally, not just daily, but seasonal fluctuations in temperature, right? It gets a lot colder in winter than in summer. And in winter, depending on where you are, it gets cold enough to freeze water. If water were an ordinary substance, meaning that the solid form is more dense than the liquid form and heavier, therefore, then when that ice forms, it would fall to the bottom of the body of water. And there would be a buildup of ice on the bottom. Then spring would come, the thaw of spring, because there's warmer temperatures. Some of that ice at the bottom would melt, but not all of it, especially the deeper it is. And by the time you get to the next winter, not all of the previous ice will have melted. But then you add another layer to it, so it gets a little bit thicker each year. And eventually, you would have a completely solid block of ice instead of a body of water. And that wouldn't allow things to live in it. Instead, though, water freezes into a less dense form, and therefore, when that freezing happens, the surface freezes. The water goes to the top, the ice goes to the top. That not only allows for there to remain liquid, because at the surface it's a lot easier to melt the next spring, and it will completely melt. And then you build a new layer the next winter, but it doesn't build up. But that not only allows for you to continuously have liquid water below, which is where the organisms can remain alive, it also, the ice layer, protects them from the winter. It makes it less cold than it would be without that ice layer, actually. Kind of like wearing a coat. The cartoons of the molecules on either side of this explain why it is that liquid water is more dense. There's hydrogen bonds involved in either case. Whenever you have a population of water molecules, you have hydrogen bonding between them. But when you have liquid water, they are moving a little faster. The temperature is higher for a liquid, right? They're moving a little faster. They still want to have that swiveling occur that I was talking about. That happens because of the electrostatic attraction between polar molecules. But because they're moving fairly fast, they swing around, but then they just lose contact with the other one. Kind of like if you quickly move a magnet past another magnet, you'll feel that there's a little force between them. But if it's moving fast enough, it's not going to stay there. All right? And so water molecules end up getting fairly close to each other because of their speed. But in ice, if you get the temperature low enough, you slow these water molecules down enough, in other words, which is the same thing as saying get them cold, then the swiveling that occurs because of the hydrogen bonds locks them into place into a configuration that kind of looks like a soccer ball arrangement because of the angles involved between oxygen and hydrogen in each molecule. And they're locked in place. Well, this arrangement, notice, has a lot of space in the middle of it. And that's why it's less dense, because of the geometry of the water molecule. Okay, let's go to 6. Here you have a salt solution in this beaker. And the main point here, as far as the importance of water, is that water makes for an excellent solvent. Remember that a solution is a mixture in which a solvent dissolves some number of solutes. The solutes are being dissolved by the solvent. The overall mixture is the solution. Well, salts are what? What are salts another name for? Salts is another name for ionic compound. What two things are involved in any given salt, in any given ionic compound?
metal and a non-metal?
Right, a metal and a non-metal, like we were talking about. There's a transfer of electrons between the metal and the non-metal that forms two ions, a cation and an anion, and they're attracted to each other, right? Ions have charge, so they're beyond polar. Polar is partial charge. Ions have total charge, either a plus one or a plus two, depending on how many electrons are being or have been transferred. Well, because of this charge, ions are easily dissolved by water because water is a polar solvent. Here you have still chunks of sodium chloride in the water because it hasn't really been dissolved yet. In close-up form, we have this. So this green and yellow mass, that's the surface of a chunk of salt. It is still sodium chloride at this point. But it's not going to remain sodium chloride when it gets dissolved. Because dissolving it, or dissolution, is going to pick all the ions apart, keeping them from each other, in which case you don't have sodium chloride anymore. You have sodium ions in solution and chloride ions in solution. But at the surface, water molecules, because of their polarity, can pick ions off of the surface one at a time. Because the water molecules have this partial charge we've talked about, and they're really small. So notice the chloride ion that's been picked off is, like all chloride ions, negatively charged. Well, water molecules, a group of water molecules in all directions, not just a circle, but a sphere all the way around it, are arranging themselves so that their partially positive hydrogens are pointed toward this, attracted toward this negative chloride ion. So you have a shroud of water molecules keeping this chloride from interacting with anything else. It's dissolved. And similarly for the sodium ion, except the water molecules surrounding it are swiveling so that the partially negative oxygen part of the water molecule is attracted to the positively charged sodium ion. So if you have enough water molecules, enough solvent, this whole thing will be dissolved and you'll have a solution, but you won't have any sodium chloride anymore. You call it salt water, but you really have just two different kinds of ions in solution, no longer a compound. Unless you remove the water by boiling it and evaporating it, then you'll get solid salt on the bottom once it's dry again. So the reason this is so important to biology is that life, which is metabolism, as I keep saying, life is the chemical reactions that occur in cells. Well, that chemistry that is metabolism is more specifically aqueous solution chemistry. So the chemistry of life happens as in solutions, and specifically in solutions in which the solvent is water. Aqueous solution chemistry. That's what happens in cells. 7 is similar. Water not only makes an excellent solvent for ions, but it also can dissolve a lot of other things that are not ions or salts. For instance, here we have a protein. Proteins are enormous compared to water molecules. This is all one molecule here. And as we'll talk more about when we study proteins later, the surface of any given protein has certain places where there are slight negative charges and certain other places where there are slight positive charges. And it doesn't matter which of those it is, positive or negative, because water molecules can surround this thing and swivel themselves just so that they are opposite of whatever that charge is. So this protein is being enshrouded by water molecules just like a sodium ion is or a chloride ion is, even though this is not an ion, this is a partially charged molecule. This close-up show you how the swiveling is different depending on what the charge is on the protein. All right, now to 8. So in this slide, we need to talk about what is called the auto-ionization of water. What does auto mean?
Self,
exactly. So autoionization refers to the fact that if you have a population of nothing but water molecules, in other words, a sample of pure water, there are no other particles in that, just water molecules, then some of those molecules of water will ionize themselves and will no longer be water molecules, they will be ions. Here we have two water molecules on the left of the reaction here. And this is a reversible reaction, by the way. That's why you have two arrows. It can go either to the right or to the left. But let's go to the right here. You're starting out with two ordinary water molecules. Each individual water molecule, of course, is an oxygen atom and two hydrogen atoms, forming two covalent bonds to make up the water molecule. All right. Now, what is a hydrogen atom? If you just consider that by itself, what is it in terms of particles?
A proton and an electron?
Exactly. First of all, it's exactly one proton. That's the only thing that makes it hydrogen. Remember, the proton number, or the atomic number as it's called, is what makes a given atom that type of atom. So if you're talking about hydrogen, there's exactly one proton. But if it's a neutral atom, and I didn't say ion of hydrogen, I said atom of hydrogen, then it has no overall charge. Therefore, it has to have a negative to counteract that positive proton. It has one electron. All right, so the vast majority of hydrogen atoms that you come across in nature are just that. In other words, there aren't any neutrons. There are some isotopes of hydrogen that have a neutron, but most hydrogen atoms are just a proton and an electron, including these two that's in this molecule. All right. What you have here occurring between these two individual water molecules is a transfer of an electron that comes from one of the two hydrogens on one of the one of the water molecules to the other water molecule. So it's not a transfer of the entire hydrogen atom. It's just a transfer of one of those hydrogen atoms' electron that goes to the other molecule. All right? I'm sorry. It is not the electron, it's the proton. It is not the entire atom, but it's the nucleus of the atom, which is just a proton. All right? So if the entire hydrogen atom were leaving one of the molecules, you would be removing an electron and a proton. Here you're removing just a proton. The electron that used to be the property of that hydrogen is being left behind, which makes sense because oxygen has a high electronegativity. So the oxygen keeps the electron for itself and allows the proton to go. Now, when you think about a proton by itself, well, I'll get to that in a minute. First, let's see what happens here. When that proton gets transferred from one to the other, now the one that receives that proton, that was just an ordinary water molecule, is now an ion because there's one more positive charge than there is negatives because it added just a positive, the proton itself. And there are three hydrogens here because the proton is what makes it hydrogen. And that is called a hydronium ion. Notice that it has a charge being an ion. But this is an example of a polyatomic ion. An ion doesn't have to be just one atom. It can be multiple atoms. All right? Well, the one that from which the proton was removed is left as this, which is another kind of ion, a hydroxide ion, OH negative. Okay? It has a negative charge because it still has the electron that used to be in the hydrogen atom, but it no longer has the proton that was part of that hydrogen atom. That's why there's only one H listed. And notice that This is just one transfer of a particle, but that simultaneously produces two ions, just like a transfer of one electron from a sodium to a chlorine simultaneously produces two ions in that situation, right? But the only thing involved here is water, and that's why it's called autoionization. Now, actually, although this occurs, actually hydronium ions usually pretty quickly lose the proton just to the surrounding, just to nothing else. The proton will just be in solution. And so instead of thinking that this is necessarily involving two, you can just think of one water molecule, which is H2O, becoming just a hydrogen ion, which I want you to get straight here. We can, when we see the symbol H plus, that's the symbol, of course. That you should read that as either hydrogen ion or proton. A proton is just another name for a hydrogen ion. It's unlike other kinds of ions because hydrogen is so simple. If hydrogen loses an electron, it has lost everything that it has except for the proton, right? Because that's all it is a proton and an electron. If it loses the only electron it has, the only thing that's left over is a proton. So a proton by itself is a hydrogen ion. Equate those in your mind, and that's symbolized as H+. All right? What's left over when just a proton leaves a water molecule is the hydroxide ion, OH negative. Now, one important thing about this is that if all you have is water, which I said you do in this example, then you can't make either one of these kind of ions, hydroxide or hydrogen ion, without making the other also, right? The same event simultaneously produces both ions. The event is the loss of the proton from the water molecule. If that happens, that one event simultaneously produces both a hydrogen ion and a hydroxide ion. So you can't make only hydrogen ions or only hydroxide ions if all you have is pure water. It's always both. All right? Another thing, though, is that at any given moment, the vast majority of water molecules in the population, however big it is, are not autoionizing. They're just staying as normal water molecules. Which ones will actually undergo autoionization is just random. It could happen to any of them. But if you freeze time at any given instant, most of them are not doing this. But a measurable and repeatable tiny fraction of the population are doing this. All right? And I'll say why the fact that it's a repeatable, measurable fraction, I'll say why that's important in the next slide. Slide 9. We have a pH scale here. And I'm sure you've heard of pH. It's really important in biology. It's just one of many variables. We've talked about variables in terms of homeostasis. But pH is one particularly important variable because it can drastically affect proteins, which we'll talk more about later. And proteins are indispensable. They do all the important jobs in organisms. But anyway, a pH scale is simply one of many P scales that humans have devised. A P scale, P scales were invented mostly for convenience, when dealing with numbers that are either very large or very small, it becomes inconvenient to write out, even in scientific notation, it becomes a pain in the ass. But especially in just standard notation. If you have a very large number, you're going to be writing, you know, some number and then a lot of zeros after it, because it's so huge. If you have a really tiny number, you're going to be writing 0 point, a lot of zeros, and then some other number. Either one of those is inconvenient. So in situations in which you're dealing often with either very large or very tiny numbers, humans invent P scales to deal with that. pH is just one of them. But P scales are logarithmic scales. And most people, day to day, don't use logarithms very much. So even if you've learned logarithms, you probably aren't well practiced with them. You can talk about logarithms using any base of your choice, but in the case of P scales, the base of the logarithm is 10. All right. So a base 10 logarithm, which is usually abbreviated just log. The log of a number is the exponent that you would have to raise the base to, in other words, you would have to raise 10 to in this case, in order to equal that original number. All right, so the log of a number, n we'll say, is what you have to raise 10 to as an exponent in order to equal n. It's easier with examples. What is, therefore, based on that definition, what is the log of 1,000? A 1,000 is 10 cubed. Therefore, the base 10 log of 1,000 is 3. Because the log is what you have to raise 10 to in order to equal that number. Does that make sense? And therefore, the log of 100 is what? 2, which is one step down from 3, right? But notice that 100 is only 1/10 of 1,000. When you go up one exponent, it's really 10 times bigger, not just 1 times bigger, right? What is the log of 1? 0, because 10 to the 0 power is 1. What about the log of 1/10? Negative 1. 1/10 is the same as 10 to the negative 1 power. Right? And therefore, the log of that is negative 1, because to equal 10 to the negative 1, you have to raise 10 to the negative 1 power, which is the log. Okay, the reason I'm going through this is to explain why the pH scale is centered on 7. You might have wondered this before. We didn't just come up with this. This is because of a property of water. So it might seem weird that you make the center of a scale 7, but it's not that we wanted to. It's that that is what is true about water. All right, but let me give you the definition of pH. pH, and the H here stands for hydrogen ions, is the negative of the base 10 log of the hydrogen ion concentration. When you put a symbol in brackets, square brackets, that means the concentration of whatever is in the brackets. Okay, so this part by itself means concentration of hydrogen ions. The pH is the negative of the logarithm of that concentration. That's just the mathematical definition of it. Okay. Now, a bit ago, I told you that in any given population of water molecules, a certain fraction at any given moment of water molecules will be undergoing autoionization to form hydrogen ions and hydroxide ions. Well, we can measure what that fraction is. That's what I said, it's repeatable. It's always the same if you measure water under standard conditions. The concentration of hydrogen ions due to autoionization in pure water is 10 to the negative 7th molar. Remember molar? That's a unit of concentration, right? So negative or 10 to the negative 7th moles per liter of water molecules are actually undergoing autoionization. And that's not many, because there's a hell of a lot more water molecules in a liter of water than 10 to the negative 7th moles. There's many, many moles of water in a liter. Okay? Most of them are not undergoing autoionization. But anyway, this is the part that's just in the brackets. 10 to the negative 7th molar is this part. Forget the negative sign for a second. What if you just take the log of 10 to the negative 7th? What is it?
Negative 7.
Negative 7, right? Because you have to raise 10 to the negative 7th power to equal 10 to the negative 7th. That's the definition of the log. So this part, without the negative sign, would be negative 7. Well, we devised P scales to be negatives so that we don't have to keep writing negatives when we're dealing with very small numbers. So the negative of the log is the negative of negative 7, which is 7. That's why the pH scale is centered on 7, not because we thought it was convenient, because it's a property of water. All right? And pH, by the way, is an indication of the degree of acidity of a solution in which water is the solvent. Well, pure water is not acidic or the opposite of acidic, which is basic or alkaline. It's neither acidic nor basic. Its pH is 7 because of what I told you about autoionization. Acids can be defined various ways in chemistry, but the most basic definition of an acid is that it's a compound that contains hydrogen, and that when you put that substance into water, it will break apart into a hydrogen ion or a proton that goes into solution, and then everything else that's left over after you remove that protein, that also goes into solution. Okay? So an acid, in other words, when you dissolve it in water, will add more protons than are already there due to just water autoionizing. And therefore, overall, you have more protons or hydrogen ions than there are hydroxide ions. Right? In pure water, you have always the same amount of hydrogen ions and hydroxide ions, because you can't make one without the other. If you put an acid into solution, you're adding additional hydrogen ions without adding hydroxide ions. So there's an imbalance between the two. All right. Now, an important thing about a logarithmic scale as opposed to a linear scale, which is what kind of scales you're used to using, like a meter stick is a linear scale. Every increment that looks the same size is the same size on a linear scale. In a logarithmic scale, every step, which looks the same size, is actually 10 times bigger than the step below it. Because each step numerically from like 7 to 8 or 7 to 6, that is changing the exponent of 10 by 1. When you go up an exponent, you're multiplying by 10 or dividing by 10, you're not just adding 1 or subtracting 1. See the difference there? So P scales have a very wide range. If you were to put that in a linear scale, it would be much, much bigger. Well, an acid is something that adds additional hydrogen ions to the solution. Am I out of time yet? Let me check what it is. Yeah, I thought I wasn't very close yet. An acid, as I said, adds additional hydrogen ions. Now, if you have pure water, so it's neutral, you have a pH of 7, right? Don't worry about the pH. You have 10 to the negative 7 molar concentration of hydrogen ions. Let's say that you add an acid to that solution, enough acid so that you make the concentration of hydrogen ions 10 times as big as it was in pure water. Well, what is 10 times as big as 10 to the negative 7th molar?
10 to the negative
6th. Right. 10 to the negative 6th. Because keep in mind, 10 to the negative 7th is 0.000001. 10 times bigger than that is moving the decimal point 1 to the right. So 10 to the negative 6th is 10 times bigger than 10 to the negative 7th. That's 0.000001. You see that? The log of 10 to the negative 6th is negative 6. But when you calculate the pH, it's the negative of the log. So it's negative negative 6, which is positive 6. So notice that when we went up in concentration of hydrogen ions, making it more acidic, the pH value went down because of the way pH is defined. So this explains not only why 7 is the center, but why acids, by when you make it more acidic, the value of the pH actually goes down in numerically. Does that make sense to everyone? Do you have a question? You sure? All right. And if you made it 100 times what it was as pure water, that would be 10 to the negative 5th, right? And therefore the pH would be 5. Well, the pH of 5 is 100 times more acidic than neutral water. pH of 4 is 1,000 times more acidic. So each step is 10 times bigger. That's in the acidic direction, lower than 7 numerically. A base is just the opposite kind of substance. A base is something that when you put it into water will break apart into a hydroxide ion and everything else that's left. So in a base, adding a base to water means now you have more hydroxide ions than you have hydrogen ions. And that's represented as a higher than 7 value. These are bases, or alkaline values. Alkaline and basic are the same. Those are interchangeable terms. It's either acidic or basic, but you can also call basic alkaline. Slide 10 is just another pH scale, but in this case it shows you some familiar examples and their corresponding pHs. Notice that gastric juice, which is the stuff your stomach produces, which is mostly hydrochloric acid, has a pH of 2, in some cases even lower. That's very, very acidic. Which is why it makes your stomach the most inhospitable place on your body to other things that are trying to live in and on you. And that's why, for instance, you swallow throughout the day. You're continuously collecting bacteria and other things, that some of which could harm you. Those stick to the mucus in your throat, and then you keep swallowing that, putting it into your stomach, because most species of bacteria can't survive that low pH, that high acidity. For some reason, they made 0 at the top, so it looks like the more acidic gets higher, but it's numerically lower as you get more acidic. Now, the big deal with biology, as I was saying before, pH is a big deal as a variable, because proteins do all the important jobs in cells, as we'll talk much more about eventually. And proteins have a hugely diverse set of functions. There's all kinds of different proteins. Each one does a specific job. But whatever the job of a single protein is, it's able to do that function, whatever it is, because that protein has a specific shape. And the shape of a protein can be drastically changed if there's even a slight change in pH in either direction. And that's why pH is a big part of homeostasis. Organisms try to maintain pH within limits because otherwise their proteins change shape and they no longer do their jobs and the organism dies. I probably don't have to tell you that this is not a healthy forest. These trees are dying. And this is because of acid rain, or more generally, acid precipitation. Water that falls from the sky is precipitation in general, but acid rain is normal rain that becomes acidified because it picks up compounds from human activity, combustion of various things. For instance, sulfur gets released by factories and whatnot, and semis and whatever. And when that sulfur, the sulfur-containing compounds that are released into the air, when they are dissolved in the water of precipitation, it becomes sulfuric acid, which has a lower than normal pH. So the rain is actually acid, not just water, by the time it reaches the plants. And you can see that that's a bad result, which is particularly bad, not just for these plants, it's worse than that, because plants are examples of consumers ecologically. Ecologically speaking, there's two kinds of organisms in the world: producers and consumers. Producers make their own food. Consumers can't do that, so they rely on the producers. And if we kill off producers, as we're doing more and more, that means we're going to go extinct. We can't live without them. All right, that's that chapter. Let me see how deeply I can get into the next one.